Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Steve Cerisi. I'm a professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst, director of our Center for Educational Assessment here, and I'm also currently the president of the NCMA, National Council on Measurement and Education.
Thank you, Steve, and this is Heather Buzik, and I'll be interviewing you today. Thank you for agreeing to be our Spotlight member. Our first question for you is, how did you get into the field?
So it's kind of funny. I was a undergraduate psychology major, and I thought I really wanted to go into industrial organizational psychology. So in my senior year of college, I started to apply to industrial organizational psych programs, and I didn't get into any. So I stayed at Loyola College in Baltimore, and I got my master's in counseling psychology with a concentration in employee assistance programs, because I thought that might help with the IO. And as finishing up my master's thesis, I didn't have a lot of time to apply, so I just applied to three schools. Two were IO, industrial organizational, and one was psychometrics. I just came across Fordham University with their psychometrics program. It sounded close enough. And once again, I didn't get into the two IO programs, and I ended up getting into the psychometrics program. And the ironic thing is, I think the reason I didn't get into IO is my GRE scores were too low relative to IO. So it's ironic that because of my test scores, I ended up going into the testing field. But when I started at Fordham, I immediately just really liked psychometrics. I liked, taking the statistical classes, and I liked learning about measurement. You know, it's really hard to measure things about people that you can't see. So because there are so many problems to solve, it really kind of fueled my curiosity and creative interest. So I went to Fordham University, and I really liked psychometrics. And I was there for 2 years, finished my coursework, and I started working for the Board of Education in Newark, New Jersey. And in that job, I was really responsible for reporting putting together the report for their Title I evaluation. And my boss at the time, came over to me one day. He said, "Why are you gravitating so much towards the statistical side of the field? You really should be concentrating on the measurement side of the field. There are so many more opportunities there." And he was right. And summer after my first year of working there, I was still a graduate student working on my dissertation. The opportunity for a summer fellowship at ETS opened up. So I went to ETS for the summer, and I started working with Howard Wehner, and then I just got hooked on psychometrics and measurement.
All right. That's great. Thank you. The next question is, if you weren't in this field, what do you think you would do instead?
Probably bartending. I say that because my number one career goal was to be a rock and roll superstar, and my lack of talent prevented me from pursuing that career. But all through college and graduate school, I was in the food service industry because, it was hard to just pay the bills. And all those jobs, I liked bartending the best because I got to talk to people. I got to, learn about recipes and, just kind of be social. So, and I've always thought, there's some background noise. If the world of testing came to an end, I would still have my bartending skills, and I could go back to that. I still play around with that a lot. Like I'll entertain friends and family with some recipes.
Okay, great. Turning a little bit to others, what advice would you have for graduate students who want to get into the field?
So graduate students who are already in graduate programs, I would say, really try and work with your professors on what they see as the next big thing, or what you think is the next big thing. You want to display that you are the type of person who will go above and beyond. So if the professor or someone who's supervising you for summer internship asks you to do A and B. Try and anticipate what the next step might be. If they ask you to do a little bit of a review of an article or two, go out and find other articles on that topic and review those too. So I think it's really trying to demonstrate that you're a person who can be counted on to get things done. There, we see some students who want you to tell them what to do, and that's fine because they're learning, but at some point you want them to show some initiative, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Show some initiative, and along those lines, having evidence that you are a doer, that you have accomplished some things, so conference presentations, publications, volunteer service for NCME, being on some committees and some other, just volunteer activities at your university, teaching experiences, helping out professors, TAing, those sorts of things. So just evidence that you're the type of person who accomplishes things and finishes projects is important. On the flip side of that, I'll give you an example of what not to do. When I became vice president of NCME, one of my tasks was to put together, committees and make sure the committees were staffed. And most NCME committees have a graduate student. And I did write to some graduate students who expressed interest in serving on a committee. And some students actually responded, "Well, I can't do that right now. I'm busy." And I was like, "Well, you're talking to someone who might hire you in the future, or you're missing an opportunity to work with others in the field who might hire you." So I think that's a real mistake to turn down opportunities. I mean, we do have to balance. Of course, you have your coursework as a graduate student, you have your dissertation and projects. But at the same time, you have opportunities to network with others in the field who are already in the field. So I would say definitely take advantage of those opportunities.
Okay. Turning back to you again, you probably mentioned this a little bit, but we'd like to know a little bit more. What do you like to do for fun outside of work?
I like fun. I believe, we should have a work-life balance. I think the more I can infuse my life with music, the better. So I like live music. I like to go to concerts. I like to play my guitar when nobody's listening and sing when nobody's listening, of course. I like to be outdoors. So I like to go to the beach or to hike and things like that. I like physical fitness. So I like to challenge myself physically when I can, although my body's telling me to stop doing that. I like to go to the gym. But really, if the more I think I can fit live music in my life, the more time I have on the dance floor, for example, the happier I am.
Okay, great. Back to our field, what would you say has been one of the biggest innovations in educational measurement in the last decade or two?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is something that's really, really new. So it's just something that's starting to evolve. And that's this concept of equity-centered design. And I first heard of it at the NCME conference in 2019. And the idea is, the typical process is we develop a test and then we see it has adverse impact or something like that, and we try and figure out what to do about it. And equity-centered design is trying to put the concerns for traditionally marginalized populations first. What could, and we, I don't think the field has figured out how to do this, but if we start with test development in a way that tries to not have adverse impact or not have items that would really trip people up, that would not interact too much with resources that are in a home with respect to interacting with a test or test prep. How do we do that? We know there's a lot of criticisms about tests being, too catering too much to privileged populations. Okay, so if we want to fix that, how do we do it? So I don't think we have the answers yet, but the conversations have started, and I think that's exciting. Another exciting development is, of course, the use of technology. And perhaps one of the most interesting things I've come across is the idea of calibrating items without administering them to people. I'm not talking about item cloning. I'm talking about some of what's happening with machine learning and natural language processing, for example. The Duolingo English test, for example, basically is calibrating some of their English proficiency test items based on how the corpus of text in the items relates to the Common European Framework for for English language assessment. So one of the big contradictions, I think, in our field is that we're developing criterion reference tests using norm reference procedures. So if we think about an item response theory model, for example, how far is the item from the person? It's great to have item and people on the same scale, but the way we calibrate is really a norm reference procedure. So the item difficulty is relative to the mean of the reference group and that sort of thing. So I think advances that are trying to get us to think about the location on a person in a criterion referenced way on a scale bring us closer to what we're trying to do in educational measurement with respect to focusing on someone's knowledge and skills with respect to a content domain rather than with respect to other people. So I think that's an exciting development. We see there's a lot more criterion referencing in the gaming industry. For example, when you advance from one level to the next in a game, it's not so much how you're doing with respect to other people, but with respect to how much you've mastered the challenges of those games. So I like the idea of us learning more from the gaming industry, not so much trying to tell the gaming industry how they should use item response theory. So embracing technology and seeing how technology could really change the way we're scoring and scaling, I think is an exciting new development.
The next one is, when you go to conferences, how do you pick what sessions to attend?
Yeah, that's a good question because the NCME conference, for example, has so many good sessions that a lot of them are at the same time. One of the things I look for are the people. There are some people who I either know or who I'm familiar with their research through, an article I read recently. So I'm excited about what people are doing. I might go seek out a person. That said, one of the best sessions I was at this past year was people I did not know who were just dealing with response data from computer-based tests. So the topic is another important one. If there's a topic that is something that I'm interested in but don't have a lot of experience with, I think that's a really good session to go to. Getting back to the people, sometimes I might not know the people presenting, but I might know the discussant, and I might know that he or she is going to give some good perspective because I've seen him or her present before. So looking for people and looking for topics are two of the big ones. Personally, I see myself more interested in some of the policy side of our field because I see educational tests are being used for important decisions that are made with respect to big educational systems. So some topics on communicating results and how educational tests might interact with policies related to English learners or students with disabilities are of particular interest to me. So I think if there's something that you're particularly excited about in the field, then of course gravitate to those topics on the program, particularly if there's a name that you recognize.
Okay. The last question is, who has been a significant influence in your professional life?
Oh my gosh, there have been so many people. I'm definitely one of those people who would not be where I am if it weren't for all the people who've helped me along the way. Three people that come to mind immediately are Kurt Geisinger, Howard Wehner, and Ron Hambleton. So Kurt was my dissertation advisor at Fordham. There was another professor there, Sun-Mok Lee, who eventually went back to Korea, who I learned a lot about multidimensional scaling from. And not a lot of people work in multidimensional scaling, so I feel like that kind of gave me an edge. But Kurt Geisinger taught me how to write, through my dissertation. Howard Wehner was just an incredible mentor and friend at ETS, and he really taught me a lot about how to publish and how to work together on important topics, how to choose important topics. And I still really appreciate the work he and David Thissen, another one. I was working with David while I was at ETS on the project with Howard. And David is just incredibly generous with his time and with his expertise. I mean, he created Multilog, as you know, and for years was just really helpful in getting me to run whatever I wanted through that program, which is a pretty incredible program. And then Ron Hambleton, another person who's incredibly generous with his time. He really cares about people and their careers, and I've seen him help many, many people, myself included. I probably have to add Suzanne Lane to that list. I've used her as a personal mentor over the years. She's someone who, from when I was a graduate student, was just always very supportive and just so talented, and has done quite a lot for NCME, frankly. And then I have a lot of colleagues here at UMass. Been just so lucky to work with, April Zaniski, who I probably worked with more than anybody. Craig Wells, who's incredibly talented. So the list goes on and on. Jennifer Randall, who I've learned just so much from. So I don't think this interview is long enough for me to name all the folks, but I've been really blessed to work with a lot of people who've been helpful to me and helpful to our field.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's the end of our questions. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be our Spotlight member and to giving the NCME members an opportunity to learn a little bit about you and your perspectives, and we look forward to the rest of your year as NCME president.
Thanks, Heather. I appreciate that, and I appreciate all you and everyone else is doing for our organization.
Okay, thank you.